Morning, Counselor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Melissa Murphy-Petros on behalf of AIG Insurance Company, Puerto Rico, formerly known as Chartis of Puerto Rico. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes.
Thank you. The District Court's advancement order here must be reversed because there simply is no remote possibility of coverage. The advancement provision itself is clear and unambiguous, and it requires advancement of covered defense costs only. The insured exclusion, or the IVI exclusion, is similarly clear and unambiguous, and it applies here to remove all possibility of coverage such that there can be no duty to advance the defense costs. The IVI exclusion here, as I said, is clear, it's unambiguous, and it is broad. It applies to any claim brought by an insured, on behalf of an insured, or in the right of an insured, whether or not that claim is in fact collusive. Courts that we have cited in our brief and in our motion to supplement most recently with the St. Paul Mercury decision that came down this past August have repeatedly found that this is a clear and unambiguous policy provision and that it does apply to the FDIC in circumstances such as those that are present here, where the FDIC is suing as a receiver of a bank, bringing suit against the bank's former officers and directors, alleging that those officers and directors breached their fiduciary duties, acted with gross negligence, caused harm to the bank, and seeking only damages on behalf of the bank, meaning only losses alleged to have been incurred by the bank as opposed to anybody else.
Counsel, the congressional mandate for the FDIC and the parties on whose behalf it can sue is very broad. The district court points that out, and then it notes in its decision that the lawsuit of the FDIC also encompasses claims of depositors, account holders, and a depleted insurance fund. Why was the district court wrong in insisting that there is a remote possibility of coverage here? Why was the district court wrong to focus on those entities as involved in the FDIC's lawsuit?
Well, first of all, one quick point with respect to the record itself. The opinion to which Your Honor is referring is the district court's order and opinion denying AIG's motion to dismiss.
Right.
That came after the advancement order. The advancement order is a very simple docket entry minute order, if you will, that says...
And you're saying that rationale does not inform that decision?
I think it does. Well, absolutely, and we stated that in our brief. I that was my second point, is I do think that we can presume that that is what the district court was perhaps thinking in entering the advancement order. So turning to the merits of that, a few things. Yes, the statute does state that the FDIC shall succeed to the rights of others, such as depositors, members, stockholders, account holders. That is clear. And for the first time in the second amended complaint, the FDIC alleged that they succeeded to these rights. The statute then goes on to identify numerous things that the FDIC, or actions, excuse me, that the FDIC may take with respect to those rights. And the statute uses the word may, and it uses the word may repeatedly. One of the things the FDIC may do is, in fact, prosecute those rights. Here, however, the FDIC has not done that. The second amended complaint, actually all of the claims starting from the initial letter through the second amended complaint, do not assert any claims on behalf of anyone other than the bank. There is simply no cause of action in which the FDIC is saying, for example, the directors and officers in doing what they did injured these account holders.
But isn't the relevant analysis, you look at the complaint, you're the second amended complaint, you look at the language in the policy, and you make a judgment whether there is a remote possibility of coverage. And if there is, arguably, then the insurance company has to make the advances. I mean, that's the relevant inquiry. What happens after that? That's a different issue. But
yeah, if I may address that, yeah. Sir, yes, that is the relevant inquiry. And when you look at the second amended complaint, claims on behalf of anybody else other than Western Bank are missing. So, yes, it is absolutely appropriate to say that we need to look at the complaint and we look at the policy. All the second amended complaint says is FDIC succeeds to the rights of these others. But when you look at the allegations of the complaint, the actions that are alleged are all alleged to have harmed the bank. The damages that are sought are all losses suffered by the bank. Even the caption of the second amended complaint says FDIC as receiver of Western Bank. It does not say FDIC as receiver of Western Bank and on behalf of fill-in-the-blank depositors, stockholders, members, etc. So we are looking at the complaint. The complaint is completely devoid of a cause of action or a claim of harm suffered by any entity or person other than Western Bank, that and they are seeking only losses suffered by Western Bank. They are acting clearly, as Judge Story noted in the Miller case, they are acting clearly only on the behalf of Western Bank.
Isn't the focus of the complaint, though, on the conduct of these officers? And isn't the gist of the complaint that the harm caused by the officers not only harmed the bank, but also harmed the rest of the stockholders, et cetera, depositors?
Yeah, I understand your question. I think the complaint is very clear that all of the harm alleged, the second amended complaint, and again, actually, the first and the previous complaint and the initial complaint letter that came in December of 2010, very clear that all of the harm alleged is alleged to have been caused by the directors and officers with respect to the bank.
But with resulting harm not only to the bank but also to the depositors, the fund?
Well, the bank, to your point, the bank is no longer in business. The fact that other entities, such as depositors or the fund, may ultimately recover if there is a judgment in the underlying action against the directors and officers certainly does not change the nature of the damages which are sought. It does not change the nature of the claim. The claim and the damages that are sought really belong only to the bank. And I think a good analogy is a wrongful death survival action. If I'm injured in a car accident and I linger in the hospital for 2 weeks before I die, there is a survival component that my estate can assert in addition to the wrongful death claims that would belong to my family. The fact that I'm no longer around to get the money myself does not change the nature of that claim or the injuries that those damages are, redressing.
I don't understand why you say that the claims belong only to the bank. I mean, the bank's failure also implicates losses by shareholders, account holders, and the insurance fund. I don't understand the notion that only the bank has a stake in these losses. These other individuals have a stake in the success or failure of the bank, and the FDIC is authorized to address their losses as well at the same time that it addresses the losses of the bank. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. The FDIC is authorized to do that, and it has chosen not to do that here. The second amended complaint, with all due respect, Your Honor, it is very clear. There is not a single claim. I agree, those other folks certainly have claims in the abstract. They are not being prosecuted by the FDIC in the second amended complaint or in any other complaint that's been filed.
But the FDIC goes to the trouble of specifically amending the complaint to make clear that it is suing on their behalf as well as on behalf of the bank.
At paragraph 21, which is the only paragraph where the FDIC mentions these folks, and it comes up for the first time in the second amended complaint after briefing on the IVI exclusion has been ongoing, they state only that they succeed to the rights of them.
Well, maybe it's not a perfectly drawn complaint, but the court only had to make the judgment about there's a remote possibility of coverage. And given the explicit statement that they're suing on behalf of these other parties, and the fact that those other parties are obviously have a stake in the failure of the bank, it seems to me the court was well justified in making this finding of this remote possibility of coverage.
I mean, I think maybe we've reached a point where we need to agree to disagree. I firmly believe a statement that says, I succeed to your rights does not equal I am suing on behalf of you. Those are two very different things. Yeah. They do succeed to the rights. They've said that. We don't dispute that. But they are not prosecuting those rights.
But this is not an Iqbal motion to dismiss where we're scrutinizing the pleadings in that fashion, is it? I mean, that seems to be what you're arguing.
Well, we are certainly, our argument is that there is no duty to advance because there is no remote possibility of coverage based upon the insured v. insured exclusion. And again, looking only, you know, I don't think we really need to go any further. We have the complaint. We have all the claims from the beginning, letter that they submitted back in December of 2010, and the policy. And when you put them together, we don't see any claims other than those asserted by the FDIC as the receiver of Western Bank and very, very plainly only on behalf of Western Bank.
What's the genesis of the, quote, remote possibility? Where does that language come from?
The remote possibility language arises from the duty to defend cases under Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico law.
Correct. Yes, that is correct, that there's now, a duty to defend or advance.
In looking at where that originates, does the Puerto Rico law specify that the complaint must state a cause of action on behalf of all these other people or merely alert the parties that there could be a cause of action? You know, remote possibility is, I mean, that's pretty nebulous. I mean, there's a lot of things that's a remote possibility. Being from Roswell, New Mexico, I understand that argument.
Well, and I'm a fan of the X-Files, so I hear you there. The remote possibility standard under Puerto Rico law looks at two factors. There will be no remote possibility where the complaint does not allege facts within the scope of coverage, or where the complaint alleges facts which make plain that there clearly is no coverage. So I read that as going to, we have to look at what the complaint says very carefully and the causes of action that are specifically pled therein. That it's just not enough to have kind of causes of action, potential causes of action in the air. We've got to look at what's there.
And that's, we'll find that clearly in the Puerto Rican law.
Yes, and that's also cited in our brief, in the first section of the merits argument.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Andres Rivero of Rivero Mestre for the defined insureds in our briefs. I'd like to address the two principal questions that the panel has asked right at the outset without giving up entirely on my outline. But first, the point that is raised by Judge Lippas, right in the complaint at paragraph 21, the FDIC says that it has rights for non-insureds. That, just to put this in context, the question is whether our advancement of defense costs in order to defend this case is barred or prohibited by an insured versus insured exclusion. So the question before the court is the FDIC a non-insured in this context? That's the question that the court has to answer. And the case law, there's an overwhelming number of cases federally, nationwide, not just in the banking context, but also in the bankruptcy context, in the insurance context, saying that statutory actors like the FDIC and its analogs have interests different from the insureds. And right in paragraph 21, Judge Lippas, the FDIC says it has those rights in bringing this claim on behalf of the creditors, the shareholders, the directors, and the fund. And more to the point, in paragraph 1 of the complaint, and let me see if I can put my hands on it to read it, here it is, the FDIC alleges that the closing of the bank on April 30th, 2010, caused a loss to the deposit insurance fund currently estimated at $4.25 billion. This complaint in and of itself couldn't be any clearer. And so, I'm not abandoning those jurisdiction arguments that we've briefed. The standard that's before the court, and this is to address what Judge Baldock has said, and Judge, it's not amorphous, and it's even in Roswell we would understand this. The cases of Quadrado and Caraballo appellate court and Supreme Court Puerto Rico cases say that when you're looking at a duty to defend, question whether you're going to permit, you're going to insist that the insurer comply with its bargain for duty to defend. Okay, they got good money in premiums to do this, to give us this insurance. Now, do they have to pay the duty to defend that they bargained for? First of all, liberal interpretation is Quadrado and Caraballo. Liberal interpretation in favor of a duty to defend. And heavy burden on the insurer to avoid it. And you take the complaint and you take, this is quoting out of a treatise called Couch, any reasonable intendment, not a construction that we use so much nowadays, but as I understand, reasonable intendant, anything that can be reasonably inferred out of the complaint. And by the way, it's not just, and it's not just the fact that the complaint on its face is plain, that the FDIC is asserting rights other than those of the banks. Remember, this was a declaratory relief action that we brought. And in our declaratory relief action, we, in our allegations, assert that the FDIC has interests other than those of the bank. So you have to look at that complaint as well. But beyond even...
Counsel, let me ask, the appellants seem to argue that there's some daylight between the duty to defend cases and the duty to advance cases, and the standard is a little more favorable to the insurer in the duty to advance cases. I gather you think that's not a fair statement of Puerto Rico law.
No, Judge, and we've cited the case law in the brief, which I don't have at my fingertips, but the case law, not just in Puerto Rico, but nationally, is that the duty to defend and the duty to advance are equivalents and that the same standard would apply. And there is, I don't even think that the insurers are arguing that point, that distinction at this point.
Well, I'm looking at this as if I were the trial judge, and what does the complaint compel me to do, or if there's a pretrial conference and things. As I understand opposing counsel, they're arguing that under the remote possibility, when you look at the complaint, there has to be a claim alleged that would be a triable issue in front of me in this complaint. And yet I don't see that in paragraph 21. All they're saying is that we attain the rights to do this, but they're not enforcing that. And so my part of that question is, has there been any expenditure of money yet that's been paid out?
Yes, Your Honor. They have, after the order, sometime after the order, started to comply with their contractual obligation to cover the defense costs in the FDIC claim against the D's and O's, answering that question. But, Judge, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Going back to what I think the underlying premise of that question, though, was, is, and let me... I believe the court lacks jurisdiction. We've briefed that, and if I have a moment, I'll try to come back to that. But if the court is accepting jurisdiction here, I think this is important so we understand the standard. If the court is accepting jurisdiction, it is on finding the practical effect of an injunction. If we are in that status, then the court needs to apply the standards on review of an injunction, which is a mixed question of fact and law, where you need to give deference to the trial court's fact determination, so that's a clearly erroneous standard there, and then on the legal determinations, of course, de novo. But beyond that, on the question of the merits on an injunction, as the court well knows, the element at issue is whether there's a substantial likelihood on the merits. So what I would urge the court to think about in terms of the standard is that what that would mean is what Judge Helpe should have determined whether there was a substantial likelihood of a remote possibility. I do not believe that in our law there is any lower standard stated anywhere. I think that is the lowest standard to be met. But it's more important, but Judge, it is important. I believe it is next to zero. I mean, it is on the ground. But if you look, there are 12 independent reasons stated in our briefs why the remote possibility exists. And going to your point, Judge Baldock, it's not just the complaint, the FDIC complaint where they allege the loss to the fund and then their right to claim on behalf of creditors. Our complaint, where we allege the FDIC is claiming for non-insurance.
But that's, would I not, as a trial judge, require another amendment to make sure that the claim is being made by the FDIC on behalf of the stockholders or the insurer? Wouldn't that have to be to clarify the issues before me?
Judge, not on a substantial likelihood of a remote possibility. If you were talking, as Judge Thompson said, on a Twombly-Iqbal standard, I don't believe so either. But that is such a far higher standard where it is, and I'm trying to remember what the exact language of Twombly-Iqbal, but it is much higher.
Plausibility.
Plausibility, I mean, Judge. We're talking about remote possibility versus plausibility. I don't know where you'd put it. 30%, you know, maybe it's along the lines of that. Remote possibility is the lowest standard. So, Judge, no. I believe not for this purpose you would not require it. But let me go beyond it, Judge, because it's not purely the fact, the subsidiary fact determination that the court makes as to who is the FDIC suing for. But there's the statute, which the insurer completely fails to discuss. 12 U.S.C. 1821K. And by the way, there's a very good amicus brief by the FDIC where the FDIC also says that their intent is to sue on behalf for the non-insureds. And remember, the only standard here is a reasonable intendment. 12 U.S.C. 1821K, suits against directors and officers are, quote, prosecuted wholly, this is as to the FDIC, when it brings actions against D's and O's, are, quote, prosecuted wholly or partially for the benefit of the corporation, which is the FDIC. So by law, when they bring a D&O claim, they are required to bring it wholly or partially for themselves, for the fund. It's described in the case law, and by the way, there's a very good district court case in the First Circuit Century that discusses this. In the case law is described in the statute, the way that this regime works is if the FDIC should prevail, and we intend to beat them at this case, but should they prevail, they would pay first. The first creditor they pay is the FDIC-C, which is the fund. So it is clear that this money, by bringing the suit, it's not just a reasonable intendment. By law, they must prosecute wholly or partially for the benefit of the corporation. If I may, there are many bases why.
Well, let me just, we have this, all sides spill a lot of ink on this jurisdictional issue, which we can't avoid. Let me just very quickly say, the advancement order, it's an order. It says that advances have to be made, and that was the thrust of the motion. The motion asked for an order that the advances be made, and it's made, and it seems injunctive in its nature. It's sort of a mandatory injunction, if you will, and that seems to be the law everywhere. So I'm a little puzzled by the contrary argument.
I'd like to join that. I can't speak for the panel, but I kind of like the Tenth Circuit case of Westar.
Judge, I thought you might. I thought you might be familiar with that one. I came loaded for bear. Let me just say, first of all, I do want to, because I didn't say, make my, I'm totally off my outline. I do want to tell the court this. I think that the jurisdiction question is an arguable question, and I understand what both of the judges are saying. However, I must tell you, in my experience, because in their brief, and they're very well briefed, there are 12 independent bases why, if we got to the merits, there's a remote possibility, a substantial likelihood of a remote possibility. I hate to use the word slam dunk, but on the merits, I think that the court, I asked the court to affirm this order on the jurisdiction, going to the point. There are cases in several other circuits that find on advancement of defense costs that there is jurisdiction in the appellate court. But Judge Lippes, what the order actually says, and I can't argue that we had a motion where we asked for advancing defense costs and that was labeled advanced defense costs, and this order says granted. It then says, though, that the text of the order, it's a minute order, I have it in my hand. Puerto Rico law requires insurers to advance defense costs if there is even a remote possibility that a claim ultimately would be covered. This ruling is without prejudice of Charters eventually being entitled to repayment. If I can quickly run through, and I understand why that would look like having the practical effect of an injunction, even though we said in our motion we were not asking for preliminary injunction. AIG agreed we weren't asking for preliminary injunction, and the court certainly didn't label its order preliminary injunction. The best argument I have of why this is not an injunction, doesn't have an injunctive effect, is the number of cases cited by AIG in these other circuits. For example, in Aqua Queen, the court there ordered payment of defense costs, quote, forthwith, unquote. It entered, as part of an order, an arbitration mechanism for disputes as to reasonable costs. And it required a bond so that the insurer could avoid contempt in the event of a failure to pay. That has all the hallmarks of an injunction in Aqua Queen.
So what is it? This is just some kind of declaration of rights that the insurance company ignores at its peril down the road, if it some kind of bad faith claim or something?
My view is it is a declaration of rights. It is, which is, by the way, and I could continue with these cases. I'll ask you to take my word for it. If you look at Abercrombie, there's a request from the plaintiff, from the insured plaintiff for an injunction, and then there's an order that goes beyond the contract rights. We didn't get anything from this order that varied one whit of the contract. Unlike all these cases, including Westar, Judge Baldock, in Westar, it really, really proves my point. In Westar, the district judge entered an order that ordered immediate payment of four defined categories and really went into detail about what had to be paid, and then the plaintiff sought contempt when there was a failure to pay. So that was a completely different record. By the way, Westar is not an advancing insurance. It's a indemnification under articles of incorporation under Kansas law. So it really is not this case. But Judge Lippes, yes, it's a declaration, or at worst for my position, an order of specific performance. But we don't get any payment forthwith. All they have to do is meet what they bargained for when they took $3 million in premiums from us for these policies, which is, according to the contract, is pay 90 days after presentment of the bills. And Judge Helpe did not intervene in any way to vary that contract. What he said was Puerto Rico law provides a remote possibility, and there's a remote possibility here. That, Your Honor, to me, is completely distinct from these other cases. I would urge the court that I believe, honestly believe, that you lack jurisdiction to hear this case. However, should you determine that you have jurisdiction, I would urge the court that the standard then, the only way you get there, is finding that this is in practice. It's not a de facto injunction under 1291A. It is, in effect, an injunction, and therefore you have to apply the injunction standard. And the substantial likelihood of a remote possibility is less than a remote possibility, and that exists here, and Judge Helpe was right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Counselor.
Thank you. I just want to address a couple points that my adversary has made. First of all, with respect to paragraph 1 of the second amended complaint, which does reference the deposit insurance fund, that paragraph does contain one sentence, which is simply an allegation of fact. On April 30th, 2010, the Office of the Commissioner of Financial Institutions of the Commonwealth closed Western Bank with a loss to the deposit insurance fund estimated at $4.25 billion. That's it. That is the only reference to the deposit insurance fund. And again, as with all of the other non-insureds that we've been discussing, there is no claim made in that complaint on behalf of them. I submit that counsel's primary argument that claims on behalf of non-insured others are reasonably intended or reasonably inferred is a concession that those claims are not there. If the claims were there, he would surely be able to point to them, as would all of us. They're not there, and so he's relying on these other standards, which are honestly not applicable when we're looking at insurance policy. We need construction. We need to look at specifically what is in the complaint, not what could be in the complaint. Finally, with respect to the duty to defend in advance, as counsel did point out to Judge Baldock, AIG is advancing defense costs and has been doing so. The duty to advance in this case, as it is a D&O policy, and this is frequent in D&O policies, is limited to covered defense costs. So it is a bit narrower than the duty to defend in a general liability policy, although certainly case law interpreting general liability policies.
That's part of my concern in the event that jurisdiction should be denied. What can be gleaned from the orders as possibly even argued that there's an admission of coverage, duty to defend and duty to pay, which those issues may still be alive separate and apart from the duty to advance costs. I mean, that's just me thinking out loud.
Oh, yes, sir. And yes, those issues certainly are alive and they are being litigated. With respect to the advance costs, as I said, AIG is advancing those. And I can tell you discovery is ongoing right now. The litigation is proceeding, and it's proceeding all on claims asserted on behalf of the bank. There are no claims at issue or that have been raised either in this complaint or have come up anywhere else on behalf of anyone other than any person or entity other than the bank.
Has there been a pretrial order or any pretrial conference in this case yet?
There have been certain conferences. I'm not sure if an official.
But the issues have not been specified.
Correct.
All right.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.